Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Doris Lessing has had a long and remarkable life as a writer. She became a literary star in 1962 with the publication of the feminist classic The Golden Notebook. Last year, she won the Nobel Prize in Literature. Now at age 88, she's out with what she has said is her last book, Alfred and Emily. It's half-memoir describing her parents' lives as they were, scarred and haunted by World War I, and half-novella imagining the lives they might have lived without the war. This hour on Point, Doris Lessing on life, war, and parents. Joining me now from London is Nobel Prize-winning author Doris Lessing. She has written more than 50 books, novels, story collections, poetry, science fiction, nonfiction. Her latest is Alfred and Emily. Martin Rubin in the Wall Street Journal says, at age 88, she has never displayed her potent imagination to better effect. He calls it a profoundly moving memoir and portrait of a marriage. Doris Lessing, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
It's just wonderful to have you, and we're honored after all these years and all this work. You are 88 with what you say is your last book, and it's on your parents. Why?
Well, I run out of energy. You know, I'm going to be 90 next year, and what has happened to me is that I've lost energy, which has never happened before. So maybe it'll come back, but doesn't show any sign of coming back at the moment.
And so why your parents? What took you to them? As if it is indeed your last outing, your last book, why your parents as the subject? What took you to them?
Well, I was, it was the war, you see. I mean, the First World and the Second. And I thought, I was thinking, as I often do, of my parents and how badly they were done in by the war. So I thought, let's abolish the war. Now, if we abolish World War I, we abolish the Russian Revolution, the Soviet Union, and all the Soviet Empire, and Hitler, and Mussolini, and the Holocaust, and World War II, and you have a completely different vision of Europe. So I simply wrote my parents' lives as if there had been no war, and they were ordinary people living ordinary lives.
It's a lot to abolish, a real act of imagination, even to try and come to grips with it, and then to make it personal with their lives. We'll talk about the lives you imagine, but would you be kind enough to introduce us to your parents, Alfred and Emily? Who were they, and what was their war experience, and how did they end up in Persia and then with you raising you in Rhodesia?
Well, my father was in life. At the end of the World War I, he went to Persia, then called Persia, where he was running a bank in a place called Kermanshah. And he didn't like that. And he said he found it... you know, he was a very moral man, my father. He said that this was a very corrupt business society.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came back to England in 25, he went to the Empire exhibition, and they were naive enough to fall for the propaganda of the Southern Rhodesian store. And
farm in Rhodesia and prosper. It'll be great.
Yes, he went to a farm in Southern Rhodesia. This was unstumped land. You know, they had to make their own fields and build their own house and everything, which was very nice for the children, but pretty tough on them since they were extremely inexperienced, seeing nothing whatsoever about the colonies. So what is interesting, when I look back at all these people that surrounded us, they'd all gone out to farm in Africa, rather like people left England to go to America, knowing nothing about America, what were they to expect? They just took wing and went. And now I look at them with a lot of curiosity. how could they have been so rash or so brave? But they did, all these people, and they would find themselves in often lands that were not developed for farming, taking on farming in a country they knew nothing about. Amazing story.
And the woman who went with him, your mother, Emily, introduce us to her, if you would.
Well, my mother was a nurse. She challenged her father, who was a very respectable soul and wanted his very clever daughter to go to university, which was quite rare in those times. She said, no, I want to be a nurse, and sort of broke his heart generally. And she went off to be a nurse. His view was middle-class girls do not go nursing. It's for working-class girls.
Mm-hmm.
But she went and did it, was very successful, was just in time for World War One, and nursed right throughout World War One, which I think took it out of her quite badly. And then she, my father was in hospital having shrapnel. You know, his leg was exploded with shrapnel. And so
he'd come out of the trenches in France and ended up under her care.
In the trenches. And so he came back from the trenches wounded into her hospital, and she nursed him, and they married. They were not people who should have married, you see. And I think a lot of children would say what I'm saying. You know, they were not suited, these two. Anyway, they married, and she went off with him, of course, his first stint in Persia, where she had a whale of a time, showing signs of a social ability which later quite astounded me and other people. And then she went with him to Africa, where this extremely English lady, who should never have left these shores, was running a house in the bush, and she did it very well. You know, she was not one of the women who everybody deplored, who made a point of not doing it well because they didn't like doing it at all. So she did it well, but she was, in fact, as I later saw, she had a very bad breakdown. Nobody talked about breakdowns, at that time.
She called it a heart attack, as you describe it.
Well, she said she had a heart attack, but she didn't have a heart attack. You know, her heart was fine for the rest of her life. She took to her bed, and I think she had a breakdown, and with difficulty got out of that bed, because she had to go on living and being this farmer's wife. And I think that she was a very destroyed woman. But I put right at the beginning of this section a quote from D.H. Lawrence, which I think is very true, and we should remember it, that people who go through some terrible experience, it's only afterwards that it shows. And particularly true of wars. You know, people can go through a war brave and smiling and being heroic and so on, and then wham.
You quote D.H. Lawrence from Lady Chatterley's Lover, saying, when the emotional soul receives a wounding shock, which does not kill the body, the soul seems to recover as the body recovers, but this is only appearance. And then when we think we have recovered and forgotten, it is then that the terrible after effects have to be encountered at their worst. Your father ended up losing a leg in World War One. Your mother lost a great love, who died in that war before her encounter with your father. And those scars, were they apparent to you as a child or only later? The leg obviously had to be, but the impact of it?
See, my father was, he also had what was used, it used to be called shell shock. But now, looking back, with what we know, he was depressed, very badly depressed. And that was how he was when he married, you see. And my mother, it took a long time for me to see all this nursing of extremely ill men for years, right throughout the war, took it out of her. And she wanted to talk about it. Now I bitterly regret. I wouldn't let her talk about it. It was bad enough that I had to listen to stuff from the trenches all the time. My father, you know, the trenches, and star shells and tanks and the whole
Passchendaele and all the mates he lost there.
All of that.
Mm-hmm.
You see? I had to listen to that, but I didn't listen to her. And you know, when you listen years afterwards to a voice, I hear her voice. I hear in her voice just how badly damaged she was. So it took me a long time to understand that. So when I give them decent lies in the first part of the book, I'm saying a lot else. I'm saying that my mother, who was such, you know, I think she was quite demented at times, but simply because of, you know, we take it for granted. Medicine has improved so much. Now, if she was having symptoms of a menopause, she'd have a pill and be infinitely better. But she didn't get any help with how she felt with a menopause. She got no help. And my father didn't get any help when he was obviously extremely depressed before he died. See, all this has changed, and we take it completely for granted. Well, I think we shouldn't. I think we should be grateful for what we've got.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Nobel Prize-winning author Doris Lessing, 88-year-old literary icon, feminist pioneer, now author of a unique new book, she says her last, about her own parents. It's called Alfred and Emily. It's half about their lives as they were, scarred by World War I, and half an imagining of their lives as they might have been without the war. Doris Lessing, if I may, let's go straight to a caller for you from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Blair, you're on the air with Doris Lessing.
Thank you. I'm so honored to hear Doris Lessing on the radio and to be able to speak to her. I read Doris Lessing in my 20s, and I'm 50, and the images of her work have stayed with me. And I think dealing with my parents and the issues that they're going through need the metaphor that Doris Lessing had. I think it was marriage between zones 4, 5, and 6 of the population that had to wear the helmet so that they couldn't look at the sky. Right? That's a metaphor that works well for me when I'm feeling boxed in, and we all have to remember to take off our helmets and look at the sky.
So she stood for a kind of freedom, or throw off the blinkers stand to you, Blair.
She did.
Doris Lessing, is that still your posture? You've got a kind of a prickly reputation in London these days. You throw off a helmet or throw off anything else that's annoying you. Is that a posture in life that you've embraced?
That's not on purpose. I didn't know I had a prickly reputation.
Oh, I read the clips. You do. I say it with respect.
Oh, that's okay. I don't mind being prickly. You know, I'm going to be 90 next year.
Yes, so be however you like.
I'm entitled.
Yes, indeed. I couldn't agree more. Yeah. Couldn't agree more. What do you hear when you talk with listeners who read all the way back through your work, all the way back to the Golden Notebook? You know, is it an ongoing conversation that nourishes you? Does it trap you in past work? How do you look at it?
Well, the Golden Notebook is a sort of special thing. You know, you said that I got noticed with the Golden Notebook. But in actual fact, I got noticed for my first book, which was The Grass is Singing. I got extremely good reviews for it.
Yes.
As for the conversation with my readers, you know, I have a lot of different readers with different reactions. I do get quite a lot of letters, which are always astonishing because, you know, a book is not necessarily read as an author might think it should be read. And that's surprising, because several times books I've written, it depends also on the country. You know, a book will be one thing in one country, let's say Italy, and another thing in France.
Depending on the audience.
Yes, you've got a different culture, different attitudes. So one has to be, just accept what comes, really. It's no good saying to a reader, this is not what I meant, because the book is no longer mine. It's somebody else's, you know, and you have to accept that.
Blair, thank you for your call. Let's take one from Peggy in Stamford, Connecticut. Peggy, you're on with Doris Lessing.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Doris.
Hi, hello.
I wanted to thank you. I'm almost 60. I read your books, the five books leading up to the Golden Notebook, 40 years ago, and they've helped me through my whole life. And I just wanted to thank you for your courage and your intelligence and your integrity and your humor. So.
Oh, thank you. Are you talking about the Shikasta series when
yes.
you say the five books? No, I'm just interested.
Peggy, what is it in Doris Lessing's work that's been the help to you? And is it the Gold Notebook most of all, or the others as well?
Actually, I think it was the earlier ones, although the Golden Notebook was really important. I read it, you know, when I was in New York City in the late 60s at Columbia, so it was, you know, helped me think a lot about different kinds of issues that I was experiencing as a young person. But I would have to say the early autobiographical, just the... Just the intelligence and again the courage of somebody making their way from, you know, one culture to another, also just the wonderfulness of the writing is just very inspiring. So the language.
Thank you.
And very wonderful in the latest Alfred and Emily. I must say, Doris Lessing through life, have you felt courageous or have you felt somehow just compelled by circumstance? How do you look at that?
No, you see, I think I was born pugnacious. It never has crossed my mind ever in my life to change what I want to say because it might upset anyone. And, I mean, you can criticize that as much as you like. It's a very, I suppose, it's a very egotistical thing. I think it's because from Southern Rhodesia, you know, Southern Rhodesia, no one even knows what it was. It was a British colony. I was a raw girl from Southern Rhodesia. And when I first came to London, a lot of people were very ready to put me down on those grounds. So I got, naturally, my fists went up and I fought back. And then, of course, the Golden Notebook was regarded when it came out as a difficult book. Incidentally, I'd like to say difficult. Last year, I'm walking in Hampstead,
yes.
And there are a couple of girls, about 15, bouncing along the pavement towards me, and they stop and say, "Hi, Doris."
Yes.
"We have just been doing the Golden Notebook." Wow. And off they bounce. So I was thinking, this book was supposed to be so difficult. Now 15-year-old girls say, wow. So I mean,
skipping through it.
it's very funny, actually, that... hilarious. But and so then I get letters about the Golden Notebook from all over the place, and they're always different, you see, because the Golden Notebook has been seen differently. Some people saw it entirely as a feminist crack track. Other people saw it as about madness. And interestingly, a lot of others saw it only politically. And now that's interesting. You know, a girl from ex-Yugoslavia says, "Oh, Doris, it was so interesting reading about those far-off times. You know, it was, as far as I'm concerned, it's just the other day. But they're far-off times."
They certainly are.
Politico
yes.
Now.
Yes. The New York Times, Deborah Solomon asked you about it, noted that the Golden Notebook hailed as a feminist classic. And you responded saying, "I don't think the feminist movement has done much for the characters of women. I mean, we've produced some monstrous women. What has happened is that given the scope to women to be critical and unpleasant, by God, they have taken it, so men are suffering from it." What?
It's true. Well, it's true, isn't it? If you just look, I mean, what women were allowed to do now, it shocks me. It's I think I said somewhere else that a really nasty, unpleasant, aggressive woman can treat a very nice, intelligent, and sensitive man like rubbish because the woman's movement says so. Mind you, that has changed a good bit. It's a bit better than it was. But I have been often very shocked at the way women take the liberty to be really unpleasant as if it's a right.
Do you consider yourself at 88, next year 90, as you say, a feminist?
No, I've never considered myself that kind of feminist. But, you know, this is such an enormous subject. One can talk about this for hours. I think that, I mean, feminism, it wasn't born in the 1960s, was it?
No.
The 1960 feminist movement, I disliked very much, and I thought they missed all kinds of opportunities, but that there's an enormous subject there. But what has happened since then is that feminism has changed everywhere, almost in some places, into its opposite. And we have extraordinary phenomena like Bridget Jones' Diary,
mm-hmm.
where it's taken absolutely for granted that women, just like Jane Austen's heroines, should be occupied in getting themselves a husband. I mean, for people who have actually been in the movement or whatever you want to call it, it's astonishing. It's I mean, Jane Austen did do it better, I will grant, and Bridget Jones was meant to be funny, and it was. I just saw the other night the film of Bridget Jones, and I was sitting there marveling. This is what feminism has led to. It's an amazing thing.
May I, you raised Jane Austen. I wanted to ask you, in Alfred and Emily, you're new, and you say your last book, we hope not, but maybe, in the novella portion, not the memoir or nonfiction telling of your parents' lives, I was picking up what seemed to me like the sort of tone and rhythm of Jane Austen. Is that accidental? Do you know what I'm talking about?
You see, because I don't see it. I was just writing what I had to do to write a novella. I don't think there are any Jane Austen attitudes in it. Do you think?
Well, it seemed like that kind of narrator's perspective to me, but then I'm just one reader. Listeners, you can judge for yourself. We've got an excerpt of Doris Lessing's new book, Alfred and Emily, up at our website, onpointradio.org. She joins us from London. Ms. Lessing, let me take a call from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Heather is on the line. Hi, Heather. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
I just want to thank you, Doris. I read one of your books, Marriage Between the Zones, in a feminist group. It actually was a feminist spiritual group,
mm-hmm.
And we it was in the 1980s, and Marriage Between the Zones. And I later got into a cross-cultural marriage, and that book and the depth of reality for women in relationships held me with such a truth about life. It just carried me through my marriage and matured me in a way that I really want to thank you. It held a spiritual and a reality that I still resonate with. And when I'm done with child rearing, I look forward to reading it again and reading more of your books. And I was so excited to hear that you've written a book about a world without war. I'm just thank you so much. I'm so interested in reading about your parents. So my question is on one level, how is did your marriages affect some of this writing in Marriage Between the Zones?
You're talking about the marriages between zones 3, 4, and 5. That is the book you're talking about. It's in a series which begins with a Shikasta. And I personally think it's one of my best books, but other people do not, because a lot of people don't like what they call sci-fi. So you can't do anything about people's prejudices. But this is obviously not autobiographically in any way, that book. But I think that if people are going to look for it, that's what it's called, A Marriage Between Zones 3, 4, and 5. And that it became an opera with Philip Glass a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
And was on in Chicago and in Germany. What else can I say?
Well, Heather asks how your own marriages may have influenced the perspective you bring to it.
No, not at all. Absolutely not. It was, not that. I mean, it never crossed my mind that it could be seen like that. you know, I got married in the war in southern Rhodesia, which is very hard to describe to people in this kind of culture. It's and the war you can't describe either because people have decided to forget it, as far as I can see. It's as if it never happened. We have kind of sort of like statues of the war, like Nazi films every weekend, which are driving you mad with exasperation. But the actual war, which involved the entire world, I'm talking about the Second World War,
mm-hmm.
It involved the entire world. Whole regions of that are just not mentioned, as if they never happened.
And yet there it was. In an earlier time, in Alfred and Emily, you write about what women faced when they married. And speaking of a sort of a different country, it can sound that way. Let me read just a little bit here. You say, if you want to imagine a fate worse than death, yes, that's not going too far. Take a woman without maternal instincts. I guess you're referring here to your own mother. Let's say in the 19th century or in any past century when there was no birth control, she would have to get married and then have children because there was nothing else for her. A woman who should never have had children had a brood and no escape unless she was tough-minded enough to choose to be a spinster.
Yes. You see, we forget what the lives of women were. And quite recently, and one of the things that astounds me most about young women is that they've got no idea at all about the lives of, let's say, their grandmothers or even their... Recently, they don't know what they have escaped from. And that seems to... I think that the pill has been a big revolution of our time, which is more of a revolution than anything else. Young women will take it for granted. They will not know that not so long ago it was common to have 10 children and die with your 10th, and you probably lost 2 or 3 on the way. All this is gone from memory. It's quite surprising. Well, here we have here, it came out of my thought that a lot of women should never have had children. I don't think my mother should have had children. She wasn't very maternal. She thought she was. But she don't forget that she was... Her own mother died when she was 3.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't have any proper mothering. She was brought up by the servants, and God knows what that was like. My thought was, all these women, and millions by now, I should think, if you look back, women who had children, you probably should never have had them. And what a fate.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Nobel Prize-winning author Doris Lessing. She joins us from London, 88-year-old literary icon, some say iconoclast, feminist pioneer, author of a... unique new book. She says it's her last. It's about her own parents, Alfred and Emily, half about their lives as they were, very much touched by World War I, and half her imagining of their lives as they might have been without war, without that war. Priscilla is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Priscilla, you're on the air with Doris Lessing.
Yes, thank you for this conversation. I have a question as well as an observation about war as a universal experience. War has been part of the DNA of my family from the Second World War in Asia, and I am in the process of writing or giving voice to that experience as a literary person. But, oh my goodness, my question is, how do you separate the deep sadness that is transmitted from generation to generation, from the obscenity that war is, from the occasional positive energy that propels people like me and Doris Lessing at age 88, I'm 67, to actually honor that experience without having to fall apart emotionally. I started the first chapters a few years ago, and I just wept because I have my father's war diary from 1941 to 46, and it is both dark energy as well as something that needs to be told because the world has to hear it.
But are you saying there's a dark and a light from war? What do you mean by that? Heroism or something else, Priscilla?
It's actually the fact that when people experience war, and this is universal, the transmission of that pain, of the losses, of the disjunctured lives of ordinary citizens, it gets transmitted from generation to generation. And I think I need to circumvent that dark pain by giving it voice through writing, so I don't have to give it to my daughter, who was born and raised in the United States and has no memory of that at all. Mm. But as the writer, the teller of the tale, I am asking Doris Lessing how she is able to subjectively incorporate that into the telling of the tale, but also objectively separate oneself from just the pain of experiencing it, because war defines a family for generations. It doesn't matter if one has moved to Harvard and gotten good degrees.
Whether it's in Asia or Europe. Doris Lessing in London, how do you respond? Do you resonate with that?
Are you talking to me?
Yes,
ma'am. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, the thing I was going to say first, that I've never been separated from it, which is why I wrote Alfred and Emily. But the other one is, what we tend to forget is, you assume that the horrors of war get transmitted, but you know they very often don't. And I have twice seen a war ending where you can see people deciding not to remember. World War II in England, there was a new generation, young people, and whereas the generation before never stopped talking about the war, either because they'd been fighting on one of the fronts or because they'd seen the lagers opened or because, for some reason or other, the young people decided not to remember the war. And to me, it was very shocking when I thought, this is incredible. The generations can't talk to each other because the young people don't want to know. And then I thought, well, hang on a minute. What a burden that do we have to carry? It's a good thing we decide not to remember. And then, of course, in Zimbabwe, the Bush War, which was absolutely appalling, I saw some girls saying to their heroic parents who'd been fighting like mad, saying, we don't want to remember the war. We're going to have a good time. So, you see, it isn't always that this suffering gets transmitted. On the contrary.
Yes, and yet there's a bit on page 170, and you're such a wonderful reader, Doris. I wonder if you could read for us. I mean, the memories and the talk of war you found as a child, an adolescent, oppressive, and you describe it there, even as a child. Could you read some of that for us?
Which one is that?
Page 170, even
okay,
as a child,
right.
I knew
That's
his obsessive. This is your father's reminiscences of World War One and how they...
Oh, yes. You see, there was no way of my escaping because my father talked about the war. Just in passing, you know, there seem to be two kinds of soldiers, one that never stops talking about it and the other kind deliberately will not talk about it. And that's an extraordinary division of people. Mm-hmm. So, okay, even as a child, I knew that my father's obsessive talking about the trenches was a way of ridding himself of the horrors. So I had the full force of the trenches, tanks, star shells, shrapnel, howitzers, lot, through my childhood. And I felt as if the black cloud he talked about was there pressing down on me. I remember crouching in the bush, my hands tight over my ears. I won't. I will not. Stop it. I won't listen. My mother's voice, I could have listened, but it was all too much. The fate of parents who most terribly need their offspring to listen, to take in something of their own substance, is often to be thwarted. My father's need was, as it were, legitimate. The trenches, yes, I had to accept that. But my mother needed a listener, and to her needs I tried to be oblivious. Later, much later, did I see that my mother's wartime ordeals were ravaging her from within, just as my father's trenches were eating away at him.
Doris Lessing reading from Alfred and Emily. Priscilla, thanks for your call. Doris, can you describe your mother's World War I losses? Your father's are easier to understand. Your mother's, how do you describe them?
Well, she was nursing when the World War I started in one of the big hospitals, which was full of the wounded throughout the entire war. She would describe how carts or lorries would drive up after one of the big battles and unload desperately ill men into the corridors. There was no place for them. They didn't have enough drugs. They didn't have enough anything. And she would talk about all this. And I know now that the whole experience got deep into her. You know, she was a kindly woman. She would not have enjoyed seeing the Tommies, as they were then called, dying like flies when she was trying to save them. That I think that she was as badly damaged as my father was, but in a different way. I mean, he was wounded. It was straightforward. He was badly wounded, and he had all kinds of psychological problems because of it.
And then there was one loss, which was of a man whom she loved in that war.
Well, that, yes, I know. Well, well, it was a very strange story, that, because the picture in the little red frame was not a family snap or of engaged people.
This is on her dresser in Rhodesia,
yes.
Now Zimbabwe, yes.
Yes, on her dressing table. Mm-hmm. The it was a man, it was a newspaper photograph. So one has to understand that, well, my father said there was an understanding. You know, my father liked this chap. He said, well, there was an understanding between them. But looking at that face, you see, that's why I gave that kind of husband to her in the first part. It was a sort of a sensitive, withdrawn, I'm not coping very well face.
Mm-hmm.
I remember looking at a girl and thinking, well, she's not going to have much fun with that one, meaning fun in the just, you know, I don't mean...
Enjoying life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I've given her this husband, who was a very cold fish, in fact. But then don't forget, people didn't know as much about love and sex as we think we do. So she knew there was something very wrong with this marriage. She didn't know what. She didn't know enough to know what was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Montpelier, Vermont, if we may. Michelle, you're on the air with Doris Lessing.
Hello. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hello, Mrs. Lessing.
Hello.
This is, I guess, the only time in my life I will ever get to talk to you, but I've talked to you in my mind many, many times. I read The Golden Notebook when it first came out and have since read really everything you've ever read and everything you've ever written. And I guess I just wanted to say, and I've read many of your things over and over and over at different times in my life. And so I wanted to just thank you for everything I've learned and all the pleasure I've gotten. And then I also wanted to say, you have written about your parents in many, many ways, like in the Martha Quest books, and then in Miss Jane Summers, you were trying to you imagined your mom as a different kind of person. And I have been more and more thinking about how people, it's an unspoken thing or unarticulated thing, how much we want to save our parents, to make it up to them, to make it better for them. And it's a lifelong desire, I think, that is rarely talked about. But you seem to have continually wanted to go back there and say, oh, it could have been this way. It could have been different. I wish it was.
And this time done just that in full. Doris?
Yes?
Have you felt obsessed with that, or is it something that's grown with age?
No, it's to do with my feelings about the wars, which, oddly enough, gets worse as I get older. It doesn't go away. I say to some of my contemporaries, do these wars sit on you the way they sit on me? I don't think they do with many people. as I've said before earlier on this program, maybe it's a good thing people forget, because it's such a weight to carry, isn't it? Well, it is a weight, because I carry it. I don't lose it. When I wrote about my mother in this invented life, the thing was that she was a very clever woman, very energetic,
yes,
very remarkable. I wanted to see what would happen if she was given scope, because that's what I was feeling looking at her in Rhodesia. I knew one thing was wrong. She didn't have enough to do. I used to joke. She should be running the Women's Institute or a big...
A great hospital in London you give her here in your
well,
mind's
yes,
eye.
You see, she was offered the job of being a matron in her mid-30s to one of the great hospitals in London. Now, women were usually not offered that until they were in their 40s. She was remarkable, and they could see it. And I thought, well, give this scope, and let's see what happens. But you see, it's not only my mother, if I can
yes.
digress a little. All my lot of women, my friends, my girlfriends, we had mothers. They were absolutely intolerable women. And we knew exactly why. They didn't have enough to do. Now we could say all kinds of clever things like, which we couldn't say then because we weren't thinking as clearly. These are women who, in the last generation, would have had 10 children and miscarriages and God only knows what, fully occupied with female things, and they had 2 children. They didn't have enough to do. My mother was a remarkable woman with not enough to occupy her. She took it out on my brother and me. We understood that, at least I understood it, perfectly well. But supposing, you see, we weren't thinking like that. We looked at these women who were driving us crazy. I'm talking about my girlfriend, these absolutely awful, busybodying women. And we knew that they should have something to do. But you see, I'm talking about a generation. I think they're much better now. I would like to rescue that generation of women who didn't have enough to do and were really quite mad because of it.
You sound like a feminist to me, Doris Lessing. I wish you'd give us one more reading, if you'd be kind enough, on page 139. And it goes with Michelle's reading and her interest in parents and maybe with age here and what we can miss. You can be with old people, it begins.
Yes, I'm,
would you,
I'm
would you mind?
I've got it here.
Yes, wonderful.
Yes. You can be with old people, even those getting on a bit, and never suspect that whole continents of experience are there. Just behind those ordinary faces, best to be old yourself to understand, if not one of those recipient children made sensitive by having to learn watchfulness, knowing that a glance, a tiny gesture, may mean warnings or rewards. 2 old people may exchange a look where tears are implicit, or say, "Do you remember?" Signposts to something worth remembering for 30 years, even a tone of voice, a warmth, or irritation, can mark a 10-year love affair or an enmity. Writing about parents, even alert offspring may miss gold.
Doris Lessing there from Alfred and Emily. What do you think your mother might think of the life you've just given her in this new book, The Imagined Life?
I think she would. You see, I haven't given her children, which I thought about that a long time, because I always thought she'd have done better without. I haven't given her children. But I've given her money because her husband dies and leaves her a lot of money. So she has scope, and she made very good use of it. And I say at the end there that when she died, hundreds of people came to her funeral. And that's what I think she would have been like, an enormously busy, effective woman. That's what she would have been like.
Well,
but instead of which, she was a neurotic, really impossible woman. And it wasn't her fault.
There's all the complexity and the gift that a writer, in this case you, can have, give a mother your own. Doris Lessing, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you and an honor. And we're very grateful to you for taking the time from London today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Doris Lessing, Nobel Prize winner. Her new book is Alfred and Emily. You may have been reading her since The Grass is Singing or The Golden Notebook in 1962. She says it's her last book. We'll see. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can continue the conversation there as well and download the On Point podcast, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Ping Huang, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Sam Gail Rosen and Will Roselip. Our senior producer is Wynn Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.